So this morning I would like to look at the power of our words and what we say and how it affects other people. Our words have power. They have the ability to encourage, to build up, to heal, or to humiliate and to harm. They can humble a heart and bring about repentance, or they can enrage a man past any logical thought. So let's turn to Matthew 12:33-37. Aunt Lauren, can you read that for me, please?
Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or else make the tree bad and its fruit bad, for a tree is known by its fruit. Brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. But I say to you that by every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned.
So according to these verses, how important are the words that we speak to God?
Are you saying speak to God or just speak?
No. How important to God, excuse me. How important to God are the words that we say?
Well, I said that they would feel our character.
Mm-hmm. They do.
What kind of heart we have.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be judged by them,
right? So verse 37 says, for by your words you will either be justified, or by your words you will be condemned. So this is pretty important, right? It's pretty important to God what we say. And just like you said, for our next question, in order to control our mouth, we first have to correct our what? Our heart, right? Because if our heart is good, then what we say is also going to be good. So, but it's the opposite. If our heart isn't right and we are thinking on evil things, then the things that come out of our mouth are going to be just as evil, right? And I also wrote the same thing you said. Our words are a reflection of our heart. Now, we know that you can't judge a man based on one case study. If so, you know, looking at this story with David, you wouldn't come to the conclusion that he was a man after God's own heart, right? So we can't just handpick one situation, but over a period of time, you can look at the words that they say and the things that they do and get an idea of someone's character based off of those things. So it is an indicator, but you can't just take one case study. So this morning I want to look at 1 Samuel 25 and the story of Nabal, David, and Abigail. And I want to pay special attention to the words that they spoke and how those words affected others in the story and how our story unfolds based off of the words that were spoken. And also to see how those words are a reflection of their heart. So I'm going to start by just reading our text this morning. Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him, and buried him at the house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 3,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. That David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. please give whatever you find at your servant at hand to your servants and to your son David. When David's young men came and they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name, then they waited. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today, are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to the men whose origin I do not know?" So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the field. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loaded them on donkeys. She said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I am coming after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain that, behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. So she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him." All right, so I'm going to stop there for now. We're in 1 Samuel 25. How is Nabal described in verse 3? Harsh and evil in his dealings, right. Okay, what about verse 7? I'm so sorry. I meant to send that out. Yeah, that I made a little boo-boo in verse 17. And yes, that he was a worthless man and that no one could speak to him, right? The New King James Version calls him a scoundrel, and I found that very interesting. Okay, so what does he say to David's servants? We haven't quite gotten there, but we'll go ahead. 29 and 30. Right, which if you're looking at... 29 and 30 is when Abigail responds. "Should anyone rise up to pursue you and seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as far from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord does for my Lord according to all the good he has spoken concerning you and appoints you ruler over Israel..." That is not what I was
reading. Talks about what he says to David,
put that
"Why
in
should I take my bread and my water and give to you?" You know, he, is that?
And in verse 10, he denies knowing
that. I don't know why I read that. I don't know why I have something in 30 down. I don't know. I'm sorry. Yes, so 10 and 11, But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David?" This is very similar to, or at least it was when I was reading through it, Pharaoh's comments about God. Who is God that I should serve him? That's what I thought of when I was reading it. But what's interesting about this is, based on Abigail's response later, as soon as the servants told her that, you know, what Nabal had done to David, she was like, oh no. It wasn't like she, you know, it seemed to me that at least Abigail knew who David was. And so it wasn't, at least it was known who David was and what was coming. So my inclination is that he knew who David was. Verse 11 seems to just be an excuse, just because he didn't want to help him. Well, that's definitely what it was with Pharaoh. You know, because of how he was described in the text as being evil and harsh and a scoundrel, that would be my thought. Who are you? And, which is interesting, because if he did know that David was the one who was going to be king after Saul, then it was definitely arrogance and pride. It wasn't,
it's been a while since he's known him.
Right. Yeah, it has been.
But he had an evil heart. Excuse me, Margaret.
I was just going to say, I think it's evident he just didn't even care who he was.
No, he didn't.
No.
And since he was rich, he didn't really want to part with anything that was his.
Right. Right. Yeah, it was very self-centered.
And even Abigail saw him as foolish. You know, he was a fool. And so he doesn't listen to truth. He doesn't listen to wise wisdom. He is a fool.
Right. Does he have a way of confirming what David's servants have said? Does he have a way of saying, okay, let's see if this is really what happened? Could he have taken that step?
Yeah, just ask his men.
Yeah, just ask his men, right? That's what the servants, David's servants, told Nabal. You can just ask your servants. They'll tell you that we took care of them. We protected them. We made sure that they were okay. What word is used to describe what Nabal did to David? Verse 14. Mm-hmm. My version says scorned.
Mine says reviled.
Yours says reviled. Okay. Did we have any others? The NIV says hurled insults. And the King James Version says railed on them. So what did you get for your definition?
Contempt or disdain felt toward a person.
Is that scorned?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I put criticized in abusive or angrily insulting manner.
Okay, that's reviled, right? Okay. So for scorned, I had feel or express contempt. Reviled, I think I also got berate one severely and bitterly, especially at length. So what do Nabal's words confirm about him? What conclusion can we come to based on what he's said?
Stupid.
He
didn't love God.
He didn't love God, yeah. Anything
else?
I didn't hear you.
He's a son of worthlessness.
He's a son of worthlessness, yes. Exactly. It goes back to verse 3 and confirms exactly what the Bible tells us about who Nabal was, right? Okay, turn to James 3. Miss Nadine, will you read verses 3 through 6 for me?
James 3:3-6.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Miss Nadine.
Chapter 3.
Yes, ma'am. Chapter 3:3-6.
Now, if we put the bits into the horse's mouth so that they will obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Look at the ships also, though they are so swayed in a river by strong winds or still directed by a very small rudder wherever the inclination of the pilot desires, so also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. He had greater force to set aflame by such a small fire, and the tongue is a fire in the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members, is that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life and is set on fire by hell.
So this to me is, this is Nabal, right? He boasts of great things and he has set his forest on fire. David is coming to get him. What happens to Nabal in the end? Verses 37 and 38 from our text.
He dies,
right?
Stone when he heard the story.
Right, and he dies. So how does Nabal's words affect David?
Angry.
He's very angry.
Vengeful.
Mm-hmm. He was going to kill them all. It wasn't just Nabal he was coming after, right? He was going to take all of the males of the household. We know from other contexts that David was called the man after God's own heart. So this is a great case in point that good hearts can be provoked to sin or to say other things that would leave others to believe that their heart isn't what it should be. But if you back up one chapter, let's go to 1 Samuel 24. Miss Linda, can you read 4 through 7 for me?
The men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, Behold, I am about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you." And David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. It came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed." David persuaded his men with these words, and did not allow them to rise up against Saul, and Saul arose and left the cave and went on his way.
And then I want to read, Miss Susan, can you go to 1 Samuel 26 and read 8 through 11? Sorry. 8 through 11, yes, ma'am.
Then Abisha said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now, therefore, please let me strike him with a spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him a second time." But David said to Abisha, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" David also said, "As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go."
So our story of Nabal and Abigail and David is nestled in between these two chapters where David is fleeing for his life from Saul. And I know it's not exactly the same because David because Saul is God's anointed. And so that's the reason why in both cases David says, "I'm not going to raise my hand against him." But it's interesting to me that this is a man who is, you know, that's trying to kill him. He is pursuing after him. And it's right in the middle of all of this that Nabal won't give him food. And not only is David willing to kill Nabal, but is willing to kill everybody, all the males in his household. And so it's interesting that, or at least it was to me, that, you know, you have a guy who's trying to kill you and somebody who's just not giving you food, and yet you're willing to kill everybody in his house, but you're not willing to take, you know, it would have been very easy for David to make excuses with Saul and be like, this guy is chasing me down and he's going to kill me, it's me or him. And yet he restrains himself from taking vengeance against Saul, but is ready to kill Nabal and all his family. And this shows a great reflection of David's love and respect for God, and what, because he wouldn't take Saul's life. But then you have this complete different reaction with Nabal, which is interesting because it's right there in the middle of all of this. Okay, so what do we know about Abigail from verse 3? She was intelligent
and beautiful.
And beautiful, right.
Evidently, because of what she said later to David, she is a godly person. She looks to be a servant of him because she saves David as God's anointed from making a horrible mistake.
Right.
And, you know, what you were saying, this is sandwiched right in between David running for his life and the episode of Saul. Who knows, but that God's intervention with Abigail here also left an impression on David that he would not do this from a vengeful thing against Saul.
Right.
Because of what she says.
Right.
You know, and that his heart should be towards God.
Right. Well, and, you know, something else I had thought about was David's condition right now. You know, he's running for his life, and not that, you know, these are all excuses, but he's running for his life. You know, when was the last time he ate? I mean, he's asking for food from Nabal. So when was the last time I don't know any, you know, the answers to those questions, but maybe some of those things played into his reaction to Nabal and what happened. I don't know. Okay, question 7. What are some tactics Abigail used to convince David not to kill her family? Starting in verse 23.
She showed honor and respect.
Yes, she did. So I wrote, she humbled herself. Okay, so verse 23. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground. Verse 24, she fell at his feet. And what does she say? Put the blame on me. Put the blame on me. I'll take the blame.
She also said, please. And, you know, sometimes, you know, that shows another underneath, you know.
There's a man in the door.
She was so intelligent, I always wonder why she married somebody like that.
Right? Right. Well, she may not have had a choice in the time in which she lived.
Before verse 23, she also said provisions. So they shouldn't be hungry before they got their first.
Right, right. Okay. But it was interesting that, you know, she says, put the blame on me, but she didn't do anything. she literally didn't do anything to deserve what was coming to her house. And she took the blame anyway, or tried to.
And asked for forgiveness.
Also through this section, she continued to call herself his maidservant. And so it was just another way of showing respect and honor and humbling herself in, as opposed to David. Okay, anybody else?
Well, she also invoked what the results would be for him if he followed through with his actions.
Right.
You know, God would not be glorified, and that God, if he held off, that God would bless him. Because there was no need to shed all that blood because she took care of the situation.
Right. I wrote that she reminded David that God was with him and in control. Like that, it's he'll take care of all of this. You don't take vengeance for yourself. she used scripture. Verse 26, now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. 31. This will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord deals well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. So back in Deuteronomy 32, verse 35. Miss Elizabeth, can you read that, please?
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
Would you say it again?
Deuteronomy 32, verse 35.
Vengeance is mine and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them.
So they knew that they weren't supposed to exact vengeance for themselves. And so she appeals to this to David. And then, as Aunt Lauren said, I wrote retribution. She brought the food. All the things that David asked for, probably plus them, she brought and gave to David. So verse 18, Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread, and 2 jugs of wine, and 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 measures of roasted grain, and 100 clusters of raisin, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. You know, David only asked for what was at hand, right? She went above and beyond, and brought all these things to David. So what was the result of her words? Verse 32-35.
She saved a lot of lives.
She saved a lot of lives, right?
David praised God.
He praised God.
And her as well.
Mm-hmm.
And enabled that. He knew what kind of woman she was. He sent for her to be his wife.
Oh, yes. David sent for her to be his wife. Uh-huh.
Because of the kind of woman that she was.
Right. Anything else? Let's read Psalm 16. Verse 23. Miss Carol. Psalm 16, verse 23. That is not going to work. Okay, let's try. Oh, it's Proverbs. So Proverbs 16, verse 23.
16 and 23?
Yes, ma'am.
The heart of the wise instructs his mouth and adds persuasiveness to his lips.
I have a footnote on persuasiveness, and it says, or learning. This to me is Abigail. You know, she used her intelligence and her humbleness of heart to persuade David to not take all of these lives, and used her wisdom to her benefit. Okay. So What I put a couple of verses here for us to talk a little bit about anger. Proverbs 15:18. Miss Sandra.
A wrathful man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays contention.
So the first part of this verse is Nabal and David, right? So the hot-tempered stirs up strife. Man, Nabal just did a number on David, and then he reacted the same way back to him. And Abigail was the one who, you know, she could have reacted the same way, get mad at the whole situation, and then our story would have unfolded much differently. But she was the one that was able to calm the dispute by keeping her wits about her and using her intelligence and handling the situation. Okay, let's look at Ephesians 4, 25 through 27. Miss Susan Dunbar. My verse 27 says, do not give the devil an opportunity. An opportunity for what?
Get in there and cause trouble.
Cause people to sin, right? So how does that relate to our story? Because of the anger that David had when he came back, it allowed that opportunity for the devil to say, okay, here we go. We're gonna take care of this. He had that opportunity, and had Abigail not have intervened, then he would have destroyed them. I mean, even David admitted that. I would have destroyed them all. In the morning there would not have been a male left. Okay, James 1:19 and 20.
You know, I think of Abigail as reading Proverbs there, 16. Proverbs 15:1 says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Mm-hmm. So you have Abigail and you have Nabal, and the result from the approach that you take, you know.
Right.
So it's a great lesson for us.
It did. Okay, I think I'm back up here to the beginning. Aunt Lauren, can you read James 1:19 through 20?
So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God.
I have heard good people who get angry at situations and then they call it righteous anger, when I don't see righteous anger as an act of selfishness. You know, when Jesus gets angry in the temple and he throws all of the money changers out, it's an act against God, and it wasn't this selfishness underlying the anger. And I think so many times the scriptures tell us we can be angry and not sin. And but the letting that dwell and the root of it being selfishness is not righteous anger. That's not what we need to be about. This verse, but everyone must be quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger. Again, this reminds me of Abigail. You know, as soon as the servants came to her, she listened to what they said and she jumped on it. Okay, let's take, you know, what we've got to do to, and then when she has this time, I don't know how much time it took her to get from her house to where David was, to think about what she was going to say and not be angry and to say what needed to be said to turn his heart. And understanding that getting angry wasn't going to help the problem any. Okay, so in our last couple minutes, what are some lessons that can be learned from David and Abigail?
There's more to being beautiful than your outward appearance. You know, it's like you were telling your child, beauty comes from the inside. You know, don't always look on the outside. Beauty comes from the inside. And through her actions, you can see that. After she had a beautiful heart.
She did. She did. Okay. Any other lessons learned?
I think one of the biggest things the way she approached the whole situation. She didn't just march in there telling David he was doing what he wanted to do was against God's will. She was very calm, and like you mentioned, she had time to think about what she wanted to say. Sometimes we don't do that.
Right. We're very quick to, or at least I am, very quick to say things in the moment instead of thinking about them and making sure that what I'm saying is what's necessary for the moment.
We can make a difference. She made a difference, a godly difference, by right behavior, even in the face of evil.
Right.
And trust in the Lord. She lived with a harsh, foolish drunk.
Right.
And she was still who she was.
Right.
Courage to act
like
that. Sometimes we don't have the courage to do that when we
feel.
You know.
Right. Let's turn to 1 Peter 3. I'm going to start in verse 8. To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. For the one who desires life to love and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So one of the lessons learned, especially through David and his reaction to what happened with Nabal, is that we're not to return evil for evil, right? And eventually Nabal got what was coming to him. Like, God's going to take care of the vengeance end of things, and we just have to worry about making sure we're doing what's right. The humbleness that Abigail shows. Let's look at Philippians 2. Verses 3 and 4. Miss Nadine, will you read that for me?
nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others.
You know, she had done nothing wrong, but she says, okay, on me. Put the blame on me. I'll take it. And she was also concerned about David having regrets when, you know, she's telling him not to sin, and she's concerned about the repercussions for David. Her humbleness of heart is a great lesson to learn from this story. And Ephesians 4:29. Miss Linda, can you read that for me?
Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will be of grace to those who hear it.
We need to make sure that we're using our words in a godly way. And think of what Abigail was able to accomplish with using words according to the need of the moment. What David needed to hear. Saying words that ultimately stopped David from sinning and saved all of the males in her household. I know that there are several times where something will come out of my mouth and I'm like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. and it, once it's out there, right? And so making sure that the words that we use are a reflection of our heart, of our respect and love of God, and that we're using our words to lift people up and try to encourage, and discerning the need of the moment. Anybody want to add anything else? And that she would handle it. You know, consider what you should do. Like, figure out what to do about this, because it's not going to end well.
Someone may have already covered this, and I couldn't hear. But in verse 32, David says that God.
Right. No, I didn't mention that. Right. I don't know exactly what that means, which is one of the reasons why I didn't say anything about it. Was that just his view of the situation? You know, was it, you know, I don't know. I don't know. That's that I don't know bucket.
Well, I have a little, you know, no fear, it says divine providence.
Right.
But I'm sure Steve must have said it.
Yeah, well, and that may be the case. You know, he's been around studying a whole lot longer than me. So
I don't know if it has anything to do with the situation, but in 1 Corinthians 10:13, it says, no temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you can be able to endure it. Sometimes we don't understand what God puts in our path to help us, what word from someone, a person, you know, a situation, whatever, to help us endure the temptation if we would just listen.
Right.
If we're aware. And so I don't know if that, you know, God does care about us, and God does help us in our weaknesses, you know, and so.
Right, right.
To keep his anointed what he should be.
Right.